the night, but shedding none upon it, its nullity more disturbing than the atrocities of Beatrix or the sealed rooms of the palace. Turning his back on both window and worshippers, Gentle continued his search for Pye, and accident finally brought him back into what he thought was the room where the mischief lay. The bed was empty, however. Disoriented, he was about to go and quiz one of the other patients to confirm that he had the right room when he caught sight of Flocus's meal, or what was left of it, on the floor beside the bed, a few crusts, half a dozen well-picked bones. There could be no doubt that this was indeed Pye's bed, but where was the occupant? He turned to look at the others. They were all either asleep or comatose. But he was determined to have the truth of this, and was crossing to the nearest bed when he heard Flocus running in pursuit, calling after him.
There you are! I've been looking all over for you!
Pye's bed is empty, Flocus.
I know. I went to empty my bladder. I was away 2 minutes, no more. And when I got back, it had gone. The mischief, not my bladder. I thought maybe you'd come and taken it away.
Why would I do that?
Don't get angry. There's no harm going to come to it here, trust me.
After his discussion with Esterbrook, Gentle was by no means certain this was true. But he wasn't going to waste time arguing with Flocus while Pye was wandering unattended.
Where have you looked?
He asked.
All around!
Can't you be a little more precise?
I got lost,
Flocus said, becoming exasperated.
All the tents look alike.
Did you go outside?
No. Why?
Flocus's agitation sank from sight. What surfaced instead was deep dismay.
You don't think it's gone to the erasure?
We won't know till we look, Gentle said.
Which way did Athanasius take me? There was a door.
Wait! Wait!
Flocus said, snatching hold of Gentle's jacket.
You can't just step out there!
Why not? I'm a maestro, aren't I?
There are ceremonies!
I don't give a shit, Gentle said.
And without waiting for further objections from Flocus, he headed off in what he hoped was the right direction. Flocus followed, trotting beside Gentle, opening new arguments against what Gentle was planning with every fourth or fifth step. The erasure was restless tonight, he said. There was talk of raptures in it. To wander in its vicinity when it was so volatile was dangerous, possibly suicidal. And besides, it was a desecration. Gentle might be a maestro, but it didn't give him the right to ignore the etiquette of what he was planning. He was a guest, invited in on the understanding that he obey the rules. And rules weren't written for the fun of it. There were good reasons to keep strangers from trespassing there. They were ignorant, and ignorance could bring disaster on everybody.
What's the use of rules if nobody really understands what's going on out there? Gentle said.
But we do! We understand this place. It's where God begins.
So if the erasure kills me, you know what to write in my obituary. Gentle, ended where God begins.
This isn't funny, Gentle.
Agreed.
It's life or death.
Agreed.
So why are you doing it?
Because wherever Pye is, that's where I belong. And I would have thought that even someone as half-sighted and short-witted as you would have seen that.
You mean short-sighted and half-witted?
You said it.
Ahead lay the door he and Athanasius had stepped through. It was open and unguarded.
I just want to say,
Flocus began.
Leave it alone, Flocus.
It's been too short a friendship,
the man replied, bringing Gentle to a halt, shamed by his outburst.
Don't mourn me yet, he said softly.
Flocus made no reply, but backed away from the open door, leaving Gentle to step through it alone. The night outside was hushed, the wind having dropped to little more than a breeze. He scanned the terrain, left and right. There were worshippers in both directions, kneeling in the gloom, their heads bowed as they meditated on gods nowhere. Not wishing to disturb them, he moved as quietly as he could over the uneven ground, but the smaller shards of rock ahead of him skipped and rolled as he approached, as though to announce him with their rattle and clatter. This was not the only response to his presence. The air he exhaled, which he'd turned to killing use so many times now, darkened as it left his lips. The cloud shot through with threads of bright scarlet. They didn't disperse, these breaths, but sank as though weighed down by their own lethality, wrapping around his torso and legs like funeral robes. He made no attempt to shrug them off, even though their folds soon concealed the ground and slowed his step. Nor did he have to puzzle much over their purpose. Now that he was unaccompanied by Athanasius, The heir was determined to deny him the defence of walking here as an innocent, as a man in pursuit of an errant lover. Wrapped in black and attended by drums, his profounder nature was here revealed. He was a maestro, with a murderous power at his lips, and there would be no concealing that fact, either from the erasure or from those who were meditating upon it. Several of the worshippers had been stirred from their contemplations by the sound of the stones, and now looked up to see they had an ominous figure in their midst. One, kneeling alone close to Gentle's path, rose in panic and fled, uttering a prayer of protection. Another fell prostrate, sobbing. Rather than intimidate them further with his gaze, Gentle turned his eyes on God's nowhere, scouring the ground close to the margin of solid earth and void for some sign of Pi O Pa. The sight of the erasure no longer distressed him as it had when he'd first stepped out here with Athanasius. Clothed as he was, and thus announced, he came before the void as a man of power. For him to have attempted the rites of reconciliation, he must have made his peace with this mystery. He had nothing to fear from it. By the time he set eyes on Pi O Pa, he was 300 or 400 yards from the door, and the assembly of meditators had thinned to a brave few who'd wandered from the main knot of the congregation in search of solitude. Some had already retreated, seeing him approach, but a stoical few kept their praying places and let this stranger pass by without so much as glancing up at him. Now so folded in sable breath he feared Pi would not recognize him, Gentle began to call the mistiff's name. The call went unacknowledged. Though the mistiff's head was no more than a dark blur in the murk, Gentle knew what its hungry eyes were fixed upon. The enigma that was coaxing its steady step the way a cliff edge might coax a suicide. He picked up his pace, his momentum moving steadily larger stones as he went. Though there was no sign that the mistiff was in any hurry, he feared that once it was in the equivocal region between solid ground and nothingness, it would be irretrievable.
"Pi!" he yelled as he went. "Can you hear me? Please, stop!"
The words went on, clouding and clothing him, but they had no effect upon Pi, until Gentle turned his requests into an order.
"Pi, O Pa! This is your maestro! Stop!"
The mistiff stumbled as Gentle spoke, as though his demand had put an obstacle in its way. A small, almost bestial sound of pain escaped it, but it did as its sometime summoner had ordered and stopped in its tracks like a dutiful servant, waiting until the maestro reached its side. Gentle was within 10 paces now, and saw how far advanced the process of unknitting was. The mistiff was barely more than a shadow among shadows, its features impossible to read, its body insubstantial. If Gentle needed any further proof that the erasure was not a place of healing, it was in the sight of the uredo, which was more solid than the body it had fed upon, its livid stains intermittently brightening like embers caught by a gusting wind.
"Why did you leave your bed?"
Gentle said. His pace slowed once again as he approached the mistiff. Its form seemed so tenuous he feared any violent motion might disperse it entirely.
"There's nothing beyond the erasure you need, Pi. Your life's here, with me."
The mistiff took a little time to reply. When it did, its voice was as ethereal as its substance, a slender, exhausted plea emerging from a spirit at the edge of total collapse.
"I don't have any life left, maestro," it said. "Let me be the judge of that. I swore to myself I wouldn't let you go again, Pi. I want to look after you, make you well. Bringing you here was a mistake, I see that now. I'm sorry if it's brought you pain, but I'll take you away."
"It wasn't a mistake. You found your way here for your own reasons."
"You're my reason, Pi. I didn't know who I was till you found me, and I'll forget myself again if you go."
"No, you won't," it said,
the dubious outline of its head turning in Gentle's direction. Though there was no gleam to mark the place where its eyes had been, Gentle knew it was looking at him.
"You're the Maestro Sartori, the reconciler of the Imagica."
It faltered for a long moment. When its voice came again, it was frailer than ever.
"And you are also my master, and my husband, and my dearest brother. If you order me to stay, then I will stay. But if you love me, gentle, then please let me go.
The request could scarcely have been made more simply or more eloquently, and had Gentle known without question there was an Eden on the other side of the Eurasia ready to receive Pi's spirit, he would have let the mischief go there and then, agonizing as it would be. But he believed differently and was ready to say it, even in such proximity to the void.
It's not heaven, Pi. Maybe God's there, maybe not. But until we know...
Why not... Just let me go now and see for myself. I'm not afraid. This is the dominion where my people were made. I want to see it.
In these words, there was the first hint of passion Gentle had so far heard.
I'm dying, Maestro. I need to lie down and sleep.
What if there's nothing there, Pi? What if it's only emptiness?
I'd prefer the absence to the pain.
The reply defeated Gentle utterly.
Then you better go,
he said, wishing he could find some more tender way to relinquish his hold, but unable to conceal his desolation with platitudes. However much he wanted to save Pi from suffering, his sympathy could not outweigh the need he felt, nor quite annul the sense of ownership which, however unsavoury, was a part of what he felt towards this creature.
I wish we could have taken this last journey together, Maestro,
Pi said.
But you've got work to do, I know. Great work.
And how do I do it without you?
Gentle said, knowing this was a wretched gambit, and half ashamed of it, but unwilling to let the mischief pass from life without voicing every desire he knew to keep it from going.
You're not alone, Pi said. You've met Tik-Raw and Skopeek. They were both members of the last synod, and they're ready to work the reconciliation with you.
They're maestros?
They are now. They were novices the last time, but they're prepared now. They'll work in their dominions while you work in the fifth.
They waited all this time?
They knew you'd come. Or, if not you, somebody in your place.
He treated them both so badly, he thought. Tik-Raw especially.
Who'll represent the second?
He said.
And the first?
There was a Yur-Temik in Isodorex, waiting to work for the second. But he's dead. He was old the last time, and he couldn't wait. I asked Skopeek to find a replacement.
None here?
I'd hoped that honor might fall to me. But now you'll need to find someone in my place.
Don't look so lost, Maestro, please. You were a great reconciler. I failed. How great is that?
You won't fail again.
I don't even know the ceremonies.
You'll remember, after a time.
How?
All that we did, and said, and felt, is still waiting in Gamut Street. All our preparations, all our debates, even me.
Memory isn't enough, Pi.
I know.
I want you real. I want you... forever.
Maybe. When the Imagicka is whole again, and the First Dominion opens, you will find me.
There was some tiny hope in that, he thought, though whether it would be enough to keep him from despair when the mischief had disappeared, he didn't know.
May I go? Pi said.
Gentle had never uttered a harder syllable than his next.
Yes,
he said. The mischief raised its hand, which was no more than a five-fingered wisp of smoke, and put it against Gentle's lips. He felt no physical contact, but his heart jumped in his chest.
We're not lost,
Pye said.
Trust in that.
Then the fingers dropped away, and the Mistiff started from Gentle's side towards the erasure. There were perhaps a dozen yards to cover, and as the gap diminished, Gentle's heart, already pounding after Pye's touch, beat faster, its drum tolling in his head. Even now, knowing he couldn't rescind the freedom he'd granted, it was all he could do not to pursue the Mistiff and delay it just another moment, to hear its voice, to stand beside it, to be the shadow of its shadow. It didn't glance back, but stepped with cruel ease into the no-man's land between solidity and nothingness. Gentle refused to look away, but stared on, with a steadfastness more defiant than heroic. The place was well named. As the Mistiff walked, it was erased, like a sketch that had served its creator's purpose and was no longer needed on the page. But unlike the sketch, which, however fastidiously erased, always left some trace to mark the artist's error, when Pye finally disappeared, the vanishing was complete, leaving the spot flawless. If Gentle had not had the Mistiff in his memory, that unreliable book, it might never have existed. Chapter 5. 1. When he returned inside, it was to meet the stares of 50 or more people gathered at the door, all of whom had obviously witnessed what had just happened, albeit at some distance. Nobody so much as coughed until he'd passed. Then he heard the whispers rise like the sound of swarming insects. Did they have nothing better to do than gossip about his grief? He thought. The sooner he was away from here, the better. He'd say his farewells to Esterbrook and Flockers and leave immediately. He returned to Pye's bed, hoping the Mistiff might have left some keepsake for him, but the only sign of its presence was the indentation in the pillow on which its beautiful head had lain. He longed to lie there himself for a little time, but it was too public for such an indulgence. He would grieve when he was away from here. As he prepared to leave, Flockers appeared, his wiry little body twitching like a boxer anticipating a blow.
"I'm sorry to interrupt," he said.
"I was coming to find you anyway," Gentle said, "just to say thank you and goodbye."
"Before you go,"
Flockers said, blinking maniacally,
"I've a message for you."
He'd sweated all the colour from his face and stumbled over every other word.
"I'm sorry for my behaviour," Gentle said, trying to soothe him. "You did all you could have done, and all you got for it was my foul temper."
"No need to apologize.
Pye had to go, and I have to stay. That's the way of it."
"It's a pleasure to have you back," Flockers gushed. "Really, Maestro, really."
That Maestro gave Gentle a clue to this performance.
"Flockers, are you afraid of me?" he said.
"You are, aren't you?" "Afraid? Yes. In a manner of speaking, yes. What happened out there? You're getting so close to the erasure and not being claimed, and the way you've changed."
The dark garb still clung about him, he realized, its slow dispersal draping shreds of smoke around his limbs.
"It puts a different complexion on things. I hadn't understood. Forgive me, it was stupid. I hadn't understood, you know, that I was in the company of, well, such a power. If I, you know, caused any offence..."
"You didn't."
"I can be frivolous."
"You were fine company, Flockers."
"Thank you, Maestro. Thank you, thank you."
"Please stop thanking me."
"Yes, I will. Thank you."
"You said you had a message."
"I did? I did."
"Who from?"
"Athanasius. He'd like very much to see you."
Here was the third farewell he owed, Gentle thought. "Then take him to me, if you would," he said, and Flockers, his face flooded with relief that he'd survived this interview, turned and led him from the empty bed. In the few minutes it took for them to thread their way through the body of the tent, the wind, which had dropped almost to nothing at twilight, began to rise with fresh ferocity. By the time Flockers ushered him into the chamber where Athanasius waited, it was beating at the walls wildly. The lamps on the floor flickered with each gust, and by their panicky light Gentle saw what a melancholy place Athanasius had chosen for their parting. The chamber was a mortuary, its floor littered with bodies wrapped in every kind of rag and shroud, some neatly parcelled, most barely covered, further proof, as if it were needed, of how poor a place of healing this was. But that argument was academic now. This was neither the time nor the place to bruise the man's faith, not with the night wind thrashing at the walls and the dead everywhere underfoot.
"Do you want me to stay?"
Flaccus asked Athanasius, clearly desperate to be shunned.
"No, no, go by all means," the other replied.
Flaccus turned to Gentle and made a little bow.
"It was an honour, sir," he said,
then beat a hasty retreat. When Gentle looked back towards Athanasius, the man had wandered to the far end of the mortuary and was staring down at one of the shrouded bodies. He had dressed for this sombre place, the loose, bright garb he'd been wearing earlier discarded in favour of robes so deep a blue they were practically black.
"So, maestro," he said, "I was looking for a Judas in our midst, and I missed you. That was careless, eh?"
His tone was conversational, which made a statement Gentle already found confusing doubly so.
"What do you mean?" he said.
"I mean you tricked your way into our tents, and now you expect to depart without paying a price for your desecration."
"There was no trick," Gentle said. "The mistiff was sick, and I thought it could be healed here. If I failed to observe the formalities out there, you'll excuse me. I didn't have time to take a theology lesson."
"The mistiff was never sick. Or if it was, you sickened it yourself so you could worm your way in here. Don't even bother to protest. I saw what you did out there. What's the mistiff going to do? Make some report on us to the unbeheld?"
"What are you accusing me of exactly?
Do you even come from the fifth, I find myself wondering? Or is that also part of the plot?"
"There is no plot.
Only, I've heard that revolution and theology are bad bedfellows there. Which, of course, seems strange to us. How can one ever be separated from the other? If you want to change even a little part of your condition, you must expect the consequences to reach the ears of divinity sooner or later, and then you must have your reasons ready."
Gentle listened to all of this, wondering if it might not be simplest to quit the room and leave Athanasius to ramble. Clearly none of this really made any sense, but he owed the man a little patience, perhaps, if only for the words of wisdom he'd bestowed at the wedding.
"You think I'm involved in some conspiracy?" Gentle said. "Is that it?"
"I think you're a murderer, a liar, and an agent of the Autarch," Athanasius said.
"You call me a liar? Who's the one who seduced all these poor fuckers into thinking they could be healed here, you or me? Look at them!" He pointed along the rows. "You call this healing? I don't. And if they had the breath—"
He reached down and snatched the shroud off the corpse closest to him. The face beneath was that of a pretty woman. Her open eyes were glazed. So was her face, painted and glazed. Carved, painted, and glazed. He tugged the sheet farther back, hearing Athanasius's hard, humorless laugh as he did so. The woman had a painted child perched in the crook of her arm. There was a gilded halo around its head, and its tiny hand was raised in benediction.
"She may lie very still," Athanasius said, "but don't be deceived. She's not dead."
Gentle went to another of the bodies and drew back its covering. Beneath lay a second Madonna, this one more baroque than the first, its eyes turned up in a beatific swoon. He let the shroud drop from between his fingers.
"Feeling weak, maestro?" Athanasius said. "You conceal your fear very well, but you don't deceive me."
Gentle looked around the room again. There were at least 30 bodies laid out here.
"Are all of them Madonnas?" he said.
Reading Gentle's bewilderment as anxiety, Athanasius said,
"Now I begin to see the fear. This ground is sacred to the goddess."
"Why?"
"Because tradition says a great crime was committed against her sex near this spot. A woman from the Fifth Dominion was raped hereabouts, and the spirit of the Holy Mother calls sacred any ground thus marked."
He went down on his haunches and uncovered another of the statues, touching it reverentially.
She blesses us because we dare to come so close to her enemy's dominion.
What enemy?
Are you not allowed to utter his name without dropping to your knees? Athanasius said. Hapex Amendios, your lord, the unbeheld. You can confess it. Why not? You know my secret now, and I know yours. We're transparent to each other. I do have one question, however, before you leave.
What's that?
How did you find out we worship the goddess? Was it Flaccus who told you, or Nicetomas?
Nobody.
I didn't know, and I don't much care.
He started to walk towards the man. I'm not afraid of your virgins, Athanasius. He chose one nearby and unveiled her, from starry crown to cloud-treading toe. Her hands were clasped in prayer. Stooping, just as Athanasius had, Gentle put his hand over the statue's knitted fingers.
For what it's worth, he said,
I think they're beautiful. I was an artist once myself. You're strong, maestro, I'll say that for you. I expected you to be brought to your knees by Our Lady.
First, I'm supposed to kneel for Hapex Amendios, now for the Virgin.
One in fealty, one in fear.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but my legs are my own. I'll kneel when I choose to, if I choose to.
Athanasius looked puzzled.
I think you half believe that, he said.
Damn right I do. I don't know what kind of conspiracy you think I'm guilty of, but I swear there's none.
Maybe you're more his instrument than I thought, Athanasius said. Maybe you're ignorant of his purpose.
Oh, no, Gentle said. I know what work I'm meant to do, and I see no reason to be ashamed of it.
If I can reconcile the fifth, I will. I want the Imagica whole, and I'd have thought you would too. You can visit the Vatican. You'll find it's full of Madonnas.
As though inspired to fury by his words, the wind beat at the walls with fresh venom, a gust finding its way into the chamber, raising several of the lighter shrouds into the air, and extinguishing one of the lamps.
He won't save you, Athanasius said, clearly believing this wind had come to carry Gentle away. Nor will your ignorance, if that's what's kept you from harm.
He looked back towards the bodies he'd been studying as Flaccus departed.
Lady, forgive us, he said, for doing this in your sight.
The words were a signal, it seemed. Four of the figures moved as he spoke, sitting up and pulling the shrouds from their heads. No Madonnas these. They were men and women of the dearth, carrying blades like crescent moons. Athanasius looked back at Gentle.
Will you accept the blessing of Our Lady before you die? He said.
Somebody had already begun a prayer behind him, Gentle heard, and he glanced around to see that there were another three assassins there, two of them armed in the same lunatic fashion, the third a girl no more than Hussar's age, bare-breasted, doe-faced, darting between the rows, uncovering statues as she went. No two were alike. There were virgins of stone, virgins of wood, virgins of plaster. There were virgins so crudely carved they were barely recognizable, and others so finely hewn and finished they looked ready to draw breath. Though minutes before Gentle had laid his hand on one of this number without harm, the spectacle faintly sickened him. Did Athanasius know something about the condition of maestros that he, Gentle, didn't? Might he somehow be subjugated by this image, the way in an earlier life he'd been enthralled by the sight of a woman naked, or promising nakedness? Whatever mystery was here, he wasn't about to let Athanasius murder him while he puzzled it out. He drew breath and put his hand to his mouth, as Athanasius drew a weapon of his own and started towards him at speed. The breath proved faster than the blade. Gentle unleashed the pneuma, not at Athanasius directly, but at the ground in front of him. The stones it struck flew into pieces, and Athanasius fell back as the fusillade hit him. He dropped his knife and clamped his hands to his face, yelling as much in rage as in pain. If there was a command in his clamour, the assassins missed or ignored it. They kept a respectful distance from Gentle as he walked towards their wounded leader, through an air still grey with motes of pulverized stone. Athanasius was lying on his side, propped on his elbow. Gentle went down on his haunches beside the man and carefully drew Athanasius's hands from his face. There was a deep cut beneath his left eye and another above his right. Both were bleeding copiously, as were a score of littler cuts. None of them, however, would be calamitous for a man who wore wounds the way others wore jewellery. They would heal and add to his sum of scars.
"Call your assassins off, Athanasius," Gentle told him. "I didn't come here to hurt anybody, but if you press me to it, I'll kill every last one of them. Do you understand me?"
He put his arm beneath the man and hauled him to his feet.
"Now call them off."
Athanasius shrugged himself free of Gentle's hold and scanned his cohorts through a drizzle of blood.
"Let him pass," he said. "There'll be another time."
The assassins between Gentle and the door parted, though none of them lowered or sheathed their weapons. Gentle stood up and left Athanasius's side, pausing only to offer one final observation.
"I wouldn't want to kill the man who married me to Pi Opa," he said. "So before you come after me again, examine the evidence against me, whatever it is, and search your heart. I'm not your enemy. All I want to do is to heal Imagica. Isn't that what your goddess wants too?"
If Athanasius had wanted to respond, he was too slow. Before he could open his mouth, a cry rose from somewhere outside, and a moment later another, then a dozen, all howls of pain and panic, twisted into eardrum-bruising screeches by the gusts that carried them. Gentle turned back to the door, but the wind had hold of the entire chamber, and even as he made to depart, one of the walls rose as if a titanic hand had seized hold of it and lifted it up into the air. The wind, bearing its freight of screams, rushed in, flinging the lamps over, their fuel spilled as they rolled before it. Caught by the very flames it had fed, the oil burst into bright yellow balls, by which light Gentle saw scenes of chaos on all sides. The assassins were being thrown over like the lamps, unable to withstand the power of the wind. One he saw impaled on her own blade, another was carried into the oil and was instantly consumed by flame.
"What have you summoned?"
Athanasius yelled.
"This isn't my doing," Gentle replied.
Athanasius screeched some further accusation, but it was snatched from his lips as the rampage escalated. Another of the chamber's walls was summarily snatched away, its tatters rising into the air like a curtain to unveil a scene of catastrophe. The storm was at work throughout the length of the tents, disemboweling the glorious and scarlet beast Gentle had entered with such awe. Wall after wall was shredded or wrenched from the ground, the ropes and pegs that had held them lethal as they flew, and visible beyond the turmoil its cause. The once featureless wall of the Erasure, featureless no longer. It roiled the way the sky Gentle had seen beneath the pivot had roiled, a maelstrom whose place of origin seemed to be a hole torn in the Erasure's fabric. The sight gave substance to Athanasius's charges. Threatened by assassins and Madonnas, had Gentle unwittingly summoned some entity out of the First Dominion to protect him? If so, he had to find it and subdue it before he had more innocent lives to add to the roster of those who'd perished because of him. With his eyes fixed on the tear, he vacated the chamber and headed towards the Erasure. The route between was the storm's highway. It carried the detritus of its deeds back and forth, returning to places it had already destroyed in its first assault, to pick up the survivors and pitch them into the air like sacks of bloody down, tearing them open up above. There was a red rain in the gusts, which spattered Gentle as he went, yet the same authority that was condemning men and women all around left him untouched. It could not so much as knock him off his feet. The reason? His breath, which Pi had once called the source of all magic. Its cloak clung to him as it had before, apparently protecting him from the tumult, and though it didn't impede his steps, it lent him a mass beyond that of flesh and bone. With half the distance covered, he glanced back to see if there was any sign of life among the Madonnas. The place was easy to find even amid this carnage. The fire burned with a wind-fed fervour, and through air thickened by blood and shards, Gentle saw that several of the statues had been raised from their stony beds and now formed a circle in which Athanasius and several of his followers were taking shelter. They'd offer little defence against this havoc, he thought, but several other survivors could be seen crawling towards the place, eyes fixed on the holy mothers. Gentle turned his back on the sight and strode on towards the erasure, catching sight of another soul here weighty enough to resist the assault. A man in robes the colour of the shredded tents, sitting cross-legged on the ground no more than 20 yards from the fury's source. His head was hooded, his face turned towards the maelstrom. Was this monkish creature the force he'd summoned? Gentle wondered. If not, how was this fellow surviving so close to the engine of destruction? He started to yell to the man as he approached, by no means certain that his voice would carry in the din of wind and screams, but the monk heard. He looked round at Gentle, the hood half eclipsing his face. There was nothing untoward about his placid features. His face was in need of a shave, his nose, which had been broken at some time, in need of resetting, his eyes in need of nothing. They had all they wanted, it seemed, seeing the maestro approach. A broad grin broke over the monk's face, and he instantly rose to his feet, bowing his head.
"Maestro," he said, "you do me honour."
His voice wasn't raised, but it carried through the commotion.
"Have you seen the mischief yet?"
"The mischief's gone," Gentle said. He didn't need to yell, he realised. His voice, like his limbs, carried an unnatural weight here.
"Yes, I saw it go," the monk replied, "but it's come back, maestro. It broke through the erasure, and the storm came after it."
"Where?
Where?"
Gentle said, turning full circle. "I don't see it." He looked accusingly at the man.
"It would have found me if it was here," he said. "Trust me, it's trying," the man replied.
He pulled back his hood. His gingery curls were thinning, but there was the vestige of a chorister's charm there.
"It's very close, maestro."
Now it was he who stared into the storm, not to left and right, however, but up into the labyrinthine air. Gentle followed his gaze. There were swaths of tattered canvas on the wind high above them, rising and falling like vast wounded birds. There were pieces of furniture, shredded clothes, and fragments of flesh, and in among these clouds of dross, a darting form darker than either sky or storm, descending even as he set his eyes upon it. The monk drew closer to Gentle.
"That's the mischief," he said. "May I protect you, maestro?"
"It's my friend," Gentle said. "I don't need protecting."
"I think you do,"
the other replied, and raised his arms above his head, palms out as if to deflect the approaching spirit. It slowed at the sight of this gesture, and Gentle had time to see the form above him plainly. It was indeed the mischief, or its remains. Either by stealth or sheer force of will it had breached the erasure, but his escape had brought it no comfort whatsoever. The Yurido burned more venomously than ever, almost entirely consuming the shadow body it had fixed upon and poisoned, and from the sufferer's mouth a howl that could not have been more pained had its guts been drawn out of its belly in front of its eyes. It had come to a complete halt now, and hovered above the two men like a diver arrested in mid-descent, arms outstretched, head or its traces thrown back.
"Pie," Gentle said, "have you done this?"
The howl went on. If there were words in its anguish, Gentle couldn't make them out.
"I have to speak to it," Gentle said to its protector. "If you're causing it pain, for God's sake, stop." "It came out of the margin howling like this," the man said. "At least drop your defences. It'll attack us."
"I'll take that risk," he replied.
The man let his shunning hands fall to his side. The form above them twisted and turned, but did not descend. Another force had a claim upon it, Gentle realized. It was thrashing to resist a summons from the erasure, which was calling it back into the place from which it had escaped.
"Can you hear me, Pi?" Gentle asked it.
The howl went on, unabated.
"If you can speak, do it."
"It's already speaking," the monk said.
"I only hear howls," Gentle said.
"Past the howls," came the reply. "There are words."
Drops of fluid fell from the mischief's wounds as its struggles to resist the erasure's power intensified. They stank of putrescence and burned Gentle's upturned face, but their sting brought comprehension of the words encoded in Pi's screeches.
"Undone," the mischief was saying. "We're undone."
"Why did you do this?" Gentle asked.
"It wasn't me. The storm was sent to claim me back."
"Out of the first?"
"It's his will,"
Pi said.
"His will."
Though the tortured form above him resembled the creature he'd loved and wed scarcely at all, Gentle could still hear fragments of Pi O'Par in these replies, and hearing them, wanted to raise his own voice in anguish at the thought of Pi's pain. The mischief had gone into the first to end its suffering. But here it was, suffering still, and he was powerless to help it or heal it. All he could do by way of comfort was tell it that he understood, which he did. Its message was perfectly clear. In the trauma of their parting, Pi had sensed some equivocation in him, but there was none, and he said so.
"I know what I have to do," he told the sufferer. "Trust me, Pi. I understand. I'm the reconciler. I'm not going to run from that."
At this, the mischief writhed like a fish on a hook, no longer able to keep itself from being hauled in by the fisherman in the first. It started to scrabble at the air as if it might gain another moment in this dominion by catching hold of a mote, but the power that had sent such furies in pursuit of it had too strong a hold, and the spirit was drawn back towards the erasure. Instinctively, Gentle reached up towards it, hearing and ignoring a cry of alarm from the man at his side. The mischief reached for his hand, extending its shadowy substance to do so, and curling grotesquely long fingers around Gentle's. The contact sent such a convulsion through his system, he would have been thrown to the ground but that his protector took hold of him. As it was, his marrow seemed to burn in his bones, and he smelled the stench of rot off his skin, as though death were coming upon him inside and out. It was hard, in that agony, to hold on to the mischief, much less to the words it was trying to say, but he fought the urge to let go, struggling for the sense of the few syllables he was able to grasp. Three of them were his name.
"Sartori!"
"I'm here, Pi," Gentle said, thinking perhaps the thing was blinded now. "I'm still here."
But the mischief wasn't naming its maestro.
"The other,"
it said.
"The other."
"What about him?"
"He knows,"
Pi murmured.
"Find him, Gentle. He knows."
With this command, their fingers separated. The mischief reached to take hold of Gentle again, but with its frail hold lost, it was prey to the erasure and was instantly snatched towards the tear through which it had appeared. Gentle started after it, but his limbs had been more severely traumatized by the convulsion than he'd thought, and his legs simply folded up beneath him. He fell heavily, but raised his head in time to catch sight of the mischief disappearing into the void. Sprawled on the hard ground, he remembered his first pursuit of Pi through the empty, icy streets of Manhattan. He'd fallen then, too, and looked up as he did now to see the riddle escaping him unsolved. But it had turned that first time, turned and spoken to him across the river of Fifth Avenue, offering him the hope, however frail, of another meeting. Not so now. It went into the erasure like smoke through a draughty door, its cry stopping dead.
"Not again," Gentle murmured.
The monk was crouching at his side.
"Can you stand?" he asked. "Or shall I get help?"
Gentle put his hands beneath him and pushed himself up into a kneeling position, making no reply to the question. With the mischief's disappearance, the malignant wind that had come after it and brought such devastation was dropping away, and as it did so, the debris it had been keeping aloft descended in a grim hail. For a second time, the monk raised his hands to ward off the descending force. Gentle was barely aware of what was happening. His eyes were on the erasure, which was rapidly losing its roiling motion. By the time the rain of canvas, stones, and bodies had stopped, every last trace of detail had gone from the divide, and it was once again an absence over which the eye slid, finding no purchase. Gentle got to his feet and, turning his eyes from the nullity, scanned the desolation that lay in every other direction but one. The circle of Madonnas he'd glimpsed through the storm was still intact, and sheltering in its midst were 50 survivors, some of them on their knees, sobbing or praying, many kissing the feet of the statues that had shielded them, still others gazing towards the erasure from which the destruction that claimed all but these 50, plus the maestro and the monk, had come. "Do you see Athanasius?" Gentle asked the man at his side.
"No, but he's alive somewhere," came the reply. "He's like you, maestro. He's got too much purpose in him to die."
"I don't think any purpose would have saved me if you hadn't been here," Gentle remarked.
"You've got real power in your bones."
"A little, maybe,"
the monk replied with a modest smile.
"I had a fine teacher."
"So did I," Gentle said softly. "But I lost it."
Seeing the maestro's eyes filling, the monk made to withdraw, but Gentle said,
"Don't worry about the tears. I've been running from them too long. Let me ask you something. I'll quite understand if you say no."
"What, maestro?"
"When I leave here, I'm going back to the Fifth to prepare for a reconciliation. Would you trust me enough to join the Synod? To represent the First?"
The monk's face broke into bliss, shedding years as he smiled.
"It will be my honour, maestro," he said.
"There's risk in it," Gentle warned.
"There always was. But I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you."
"How so?"
"You're my inspiration, maestro,"
the man replied, inclining his head in deference.
"Whatever you require of me, I'll perform as best I can."
"Stay here, then. Watch the erasure and wait. I'll find you when the time comes."
He spoke with more certainty than he felt, but then perhaps the illusion of competence was part of every maestro's repertoire.
"I'll be waiting," the monk replied.
"What's your name?"
"When I joined the Dirthers, they called me Chica Jackeen."
"Jackeen?"
"It means worthless fellow," the man replied.
"Then we've got much in common," Gentle said.
He took the man's hand and shook it.
"Remember me, Jackeen."
"You've never left my mind,"
the man replied. There was some subtext here Gentle couldn't grasp, but this was no time to delve. He had two demanding and dangerous journeys ahead of him, the first to Isorderex, the second from that city back to the retreat. Thanking Jackeen for his good offices, Gentle left him at the erasure and picked his way back through the devastation towards the Circle of Madonnas. Some of the survivors were leaving its shelter to begin a search of the site, presumably in the hope, vain he suspected, of finding others alive. It was a scene of grief and bewilderment he'd witnessed too many times on his journey through the Dominions. Much as he would have liked to believe it was mere happenstance that these scenes of devastation coincided with his presence, he couldn't afford to indulge such self-delusion. He was as surely wedded to the storm as he was to Pi. More so, now, perhaps, with the mischief gone. Jackeen's observation that Athanasius was too purposeful a soul to have perished was confirmed as Gentle drew closer to the circle. The man was standing at the centre of a knot of Dirthers, leading a prayer of thanks to the Holy Mother for their survival. As Gentle reached the perimeter, Athanasius raised his head. One eye was closed beneath a scab of blood and dirt, but there was enough hatred in the other to burn in a dozen eyes. Meeting its gaze, Gentle advanced no further, but the priest dropped the volume of his prayer to a whisper anyway, preventing the trespasser from hearing the terms of his devotion. Gentle's ears were not so dulled by the din he didn't catch a few of the phrases, however. Though the woman represented in so many modes around the circle was clearly the Virgin Mary, she apparently went by other names here, or else had sisters. He heard her called Uma Umagamagai, Mother Imagica, and heard too the name Hussar had first whispered to him in her cell beneath the Maison de Santé, Tishalulay. There was a third, though it took Gentle a little time to be certain he'd understood the naming aright, and that was Jokalelal. Athanasius prayed that she'd keep a place for them at her side in the snows of paradise, which made Gentle wonder rather sourly if the man had ever trodden those wastes, that he could think them a heavenly place. Though the names were strange, the inspiring spirit was not. Athanasius and his forlorn congregation were praying to the same loving goddess at whose shrines in the Fifth countless candles were lit every day. Even gentle at his most pagan had conceded the presence of that woman in his life and worshipped her the only way he'd known how, with the seduction and temporary possession of her sex. Had he known a mother or a loving sister, he might have learned a better devotion than lust. But he hoped and believed the holy woman would forgive him his trespasses, even if Athanasius would not. The thought comforted him. He would need all the protection he could assemble in the battle that lay ahead, and it was no little solace to think that the Mother Imagica had her worshipping places in the Fifth, where that battle would be fought. With the ad hoc service over, Athanasius let his congregation go about the business of searching the wreckage. For his part, he stayed in the middle of the circle, where a few survivors who'd made it that far but perished lay sprawled.
"Come here, maestro," Athanasius said. "There's something you should see."
Gentle stepped into the circle, expecting Athanasius to show him the corpse of a child, or some fragile beauty, broken. But the face at his feet was male, and far from innocent.
"You knew him, I think."
"Yes. His name was Esterbrook."
Charlie's eyes were closed, his mouth, too, sealed up in the moment of his passing. There was very little sign of physical damage. Perhaps his heart had simply given out in the excitement.
"Nicetamus said you brought him here because you thought he was me."
"We thought he was a messiah," Athanasius said. "When we realized he wasn't, we kept looking, expecting a miracle. Instead,
you got me. For what it's worth, you were right. I did bring all this destruction with me. I don't quite know why, and I don't expect you to forgive me for it, but I want you to understand that I take no pleasure in it. All I want to do is make good the damage I've done."
"And how will you do that, maestro?"
Athanasius said. His one good eye brimmed with tears as he surveyed the bodies.
"How will you make this good? Can you resurrect them with what's between your legs? Is that the trick of it? Can you fuck them back into life?"
Gentle made a guttural sound of disgust.
"Well, that's what you maestros think, isn't it? You don't want to suffer. You just want the glory. You lay your rod on the land, and the land bears fruit. That's what you think. But it doesn't work that way. It's your blood the land wants. It's your sacrifice. And as long as you deny that, others are going to die in your place. Believe me, I'd cut my throat now if I thought I could raise these people. But I've been played a wretched trick. I've the will to do it, but my blood's not worth a damn. Yours is. I don't know why. I wish it weren't. But it is."
"Would Uma Umagamagai like to see me bleed?" Gentle said. "Or Tisha Lule? Or Joka Leilau? Is that what your loving mothers want from this child?"
"You don't belong to them. I don't know who you belong to, but you didn't come from their sweet bodies."
"I must have come from somewhere," Gentle said,
voicing that thought for the first time in his life. "I've got a purpose in me, and I think God put it there."
"Don't look too far, maestro. Your ignorance may be the only defense the rest of us have got against you. Give up your ambition now before you find out what you're really capable of."
"I can't."
"Oh, but it's easy," Athanasius said. "Kill yourself, maestro. Let the land have your blood. That's the greatest service you could do the Dominions now."
There was the bitterest echo in these words of a letter he'd read months ago in another kind of wilderness. "Do this for the women of the world," Vanessa had written. "Slit your lying throat." Had he really travelled the Dominions simply to have the advice he'd been given by a woman whom he'd cheated in love returned to him? After all this striving for comprehension, was he finally as injurious and fraudulent a maestro as he was a lover? Athanasius read the accuracy of this last dart off his target's face, and with a feral grin hammered it home.
"Do it soon, maestro," he said. "There are enough orphans in the Dominions already, without you indulging your ambitions for another day."
Gentle let these cruelties go.
"You married me to the love of my life, Athanasius," he said. I won't ever forget that kindness.
Poor Pai Opa,
the other man replied, grinding the point home.
Another of your victims. What a poison there must be in you, maestro.
Gentle turned and left the circle without responding, with Athanasius repeating his earlier advice to usher him on his way.
Kill yourself soon, maestro, he said. For you, for Pai, for all of us. Kill yourself soon.
2. It took Gentle a quarter of an hour to make his way through the ravagement to open ground, hoping as he went that he'd find some vehicle, Flocus's perhaps, that he could commandeer for the return journey to his Ordorex. If he found nothing, it would be a long trek on foot, but that would have to be the way of it. What little illumination the fires behind him proffered soon dwindled, and he was obliged to search by starlight, which would most probably have failed to show him the vehicle had his path not been redirected by the squeals of Flocus Dado's porcine pet Sci-Shy, who, along with her litter, was still inside. The car had been thrown over in the storm, and so he went to it simply to let the animals out, planning to go on to find another. But as he struggled with a handle, a human face appeared at the steamed-up window. Flocus was inside, and greeted Gentle's appearance with a clamour of relief almost as high-pitched as Slyshy's. Gentle clambered up onto the side of the car and, after much swearing and sweating, wrenched the door open with brute force.
"Oh, you're a sight to behold, maestro," Flocus said. "I thought I was going to suffocate in there."
The stench was piercing, and it came with Flocus when he clambered out. His clothes were caked in the litter's excrement, and Mama's too.
"How the hell did you get in there?" Gentle asked him.
Flocus wiped a turd trail off his spectacles and blinked at his saviour through them.
"When Athanasius told me to summon you, I thought, something's wrong here, Dado. You'd better go while you can. I just got into the car when the storm started, and it was simply turned over, with all of us inside. The windows are unbreakable, and the locks were jammed. I couldn't get out."
"You were lucky to be in there."
"So I see,"
Flocus observed, surveying the distant vista of destruction.
"What happened out here?"
"Something came out of the first, in pursuit of Pai Opa."
"The Unbeheld did this?"
"So it would seem."
"Unkind,"
Flocus said softly, which was surely the understatement of the night. Flocus lifted Sci-Shy and her litter, two of which had perished when their mother fell on them, out of the vehicle, and he and Gentle set to the task of putting it back on four wheels. It took some doing, but Flocus made up in strength what he lacked in height, and between the two of them the job was done. Gentle had made plain his intention to return to his Ordorex, but wasn't certain of Flocus's intentions until the engine was running. Then he said, "Are you coming with me?"
"I should stay,"
Flocus replied. There was a fretful pause.
"But I've never been much good with death."
"You said the same thing about sex."
"It's true."
"That doesn't leave much, does it?"
"Would you prefer to go without me, maestro?"
"Not at all. If you want to come, come. But let's get going. I want to be in his Ordorex by dawn."
"Why? What happens at dawn?"
Flocus said, a superstitious flutter in his voice. "It's a new day."
"Should we be grateful for that?"
the other man inquired, as though he sniffed some profound wisdom in the maestro's reply, but couldn't quite grasp it.
"Indeed we should, Flocus. Indeed we should. For the day, and for the chance."
What chance would that be exactly?"
"The chance to change the world."
"Ah," said Flocus, "of course, to change the world. I'll make that my prayer from now on."
"We'll compose it together, Flocus. We've got to invent everything from now on, who we are, what we believe. There's been too many old roads taken, too many old dramas repeated. We've got to find a new way by tomorrow."
"A new way?"
"That's right. We'll make that our ambition, agreed? To be new men by the time the comet comes up." Flocus's doubt was visible even by starlight.
"That doesn't give us very long," he observed.
True enough, Gentle thought. In the fifth, midsummer could not be very far off, and though he didn't yet comprehend the reasons, he knew the reconciliation could only be performed on that day. There was a fine irony. Having frittered away lifetimes in pursuit of sensation, the span he had left in which to make good the error of that waste could be measured in terms of hours. "There'll be time," he said, hoping to answer Flaccus's doubts and subdue his own, but knowing in his heart of hearts that he was doing neither. Chapter 6 1 Jude was stirred from the torpor Quaeswa's narcotic bed had induced in her, not by sound. She'd long since become accustomed to the anarchy that had raged unabated throughout the night, but by a sense of unease too vague to be identified and too insistent to be ignored. Something of consequence had happened in the Dominion, and though her wits were dulled by indulgence, she woke too agitated to return to the comfort of a scented pillow. Head throbbing, she heaved herself up out of the bed and went in search of her sister. Concupiscentia was at the door, with a sly smile on her face. Jude half remembered the creature slipping into one of her drugged dreams, but the details were hazy and the foreboding she'd woken with was more important now than remembering the fantasies that had gone before. She found Quaeswa in a darkened room, sitting beside the window.
"Did something wake you, sister?" Quaeswa asked her. "I don't quite know what, but yes. Do you know what it was?" "Something in the desert," Quaeswa replied, turning her head towards the window, though she lacked the eyes to see what lay outside. "Something momentous. Is there any way of finding out what?" Quaeswa took a deep breath. "No easy way. But there is one." "Yes. There's a place beneath the pivot tower."
Concupiscentia had followed Judith into the room, but now, at the mention of this place, she made to withdraw. She was neither quiet nor fast enough, however. Quaeswa summoned her back.
"Don't be afraid," she told the creature. "We don't need you with us once we're inside. But fetch a lamp, will you? And something to eat and drink. We may be there a while."
It was half a day and more since Jude and Quaeswa had taken refuge in the suite of chambers, and in that time any last occupants of the palace had made their escape, doubtless fearing the revolutionary zeal that would want the fortress cleansed of the autarch's excesses down to the last bureaucrat. Those bureaucrats had fled, but the zealots hadn't appeared in their place. Though Jude had heard commotion in the courtyards as she'd dozed, it had never come close. Either the fury that had moved the tide was exhausted, and the insurgents were resting before they began their assault on the palace, or else their fervour had lost its singular purpose altogether, and the commotion she'd heard was factions battling with each other for the right to plunder, which conflicts had destroyed them all, left, right and centre. Whatever the consequence was the same, a palace built to house many thousands of souls, servants, soldiers, pen-pushers, cooks, stewards, messengers, torturers and major domos, was deserted. And they went through it, Jude led by Concupiscentia's lamp, Quaeswa led by Jude, like three tiny specks of life lost in a vast and dark machine. The only sounds were their footsteps, and those that said machine made as it ran down. Hot water pipes ticking as the furnaces that fed them guttered out, shutters beating themselves to splinters in empty rooms, guard dogs barking on gnawed leashes, fearful their masters would not come again. Nor would they. The furnaces would cool, the shutters break, and the dogs, trained to bring death, would have it come to them in their turn. The age of the autarch Sartori was over, and no new age had yet begun. As they walked, Jude asked for an explanation of the place to which they were going, and by way of reply Quaeswa offered first a history of the pivot. Of all the autarch's devices to subdue and rule the reconciled dominions,